And the gospel lesson comes from the 9th chapter of Mark. John said to Jesus, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he was not following us." But Jesus said, "Do not stop him, for no one who does a deed of power in my name will soon be able to speak evil of me. Whoever is not against us is for us. For truly I tell you, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you bear the name of Christ will by no means lose the reward. If any of you put a stumbling block before one of these little ones who believe in me, it would be better for you if a great millstone were hung around your neck and you were thrown into the sea. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life maimed than to have two hands and go to..." I'm going to use the word that's actually in the original Greek. It's Gehenna. It gets translated hell, and that may not be a really good word because we have all sorts of preconceived notions about that. Gehenna comes from the Hebrew Gar Hinnom. It was the dump outside of Jerusalem to the south and west of the city. This was where back in the old days people performed child sacrifices to Moloch. It was considered contaminated and evil, and so that became the town dump. That's where the garbage was strewn. That's where the dead animals were put. That's where dead people who could not be buried properly were put. Everything was on fire. Everything stunk. It was a powerful metaphor for what a life that was lived bent in on itself would turn oneself into. So don't think of a place with pitchforks and guys with red tails. This is about what is a life with oneself at the center versus a life with God at the center. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life maimed than to have two hands and go to Gehenna, to the unquenchable fire. And if your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life lame than to have two feet and to be thrown into Gehenna. And if your eye causes you to stumble, tear it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than to have two eyes and to be thrown into Gehenna, where their worm never dies and the fire is never quenched. For everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good, but if salt has lost its saltiness, how can you season it? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. When I was in high school, I don't know if my pastor at Fox Lake Baptist Church ever preached on this text, but I do remember the first time I read it. On my own, for the first time, in my shiny new leather-bound New International Version that I received the year before in eighth grade. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. And if your eye causes you to stumble, tear it out. And if your eye causes you to stumble, rip it off. Jesus, I wish you hadn't said that, I thought. Because when I read that, all I could think of was, well, me. It was 1976. I was a testosterone-drenched 14-year-old freshman boy. Girls in my school had started wearing something called Gloria Vanderbilt jeans. Farrah Fawcett had just come out with that poster, and a rather titillating show called Charlie's Angels had started playing on TV. This Baptist boy was a little bit more than just a tad distracted. by all of this. My eyes and my hands were causing me to stumble constantly. And in this horrible text from Mark's gospel, Jesus, far more sternly than my Baptist pastor could have imagined preaching, was telling me that the cure for all my distracted body parts was a meat cleaver. Not the most nuanced of cures for adolescent overstimulation. I remember for weeks feeling guilty and scared and frankly a little uneasy around kitchen utensils. Now, fortunately, I never took the reading quite as literally as the church said I was supposed to take things that Jesus said. And I got through high school with all my parts relatively intact. But I wondered for a long time, what on earth is Jesus talking about here? I'll set you up with a little bit of context. In Mark chapter 9, the disciples are majoring in not understanding anything that Jesus is saying. They were just up on the mountaintop, where they saw this amazing transfiguration scene. They didn't understand it. On the way down from the mountain, Jesus talked about how he was going to have to be crucified and rise on the third day. They had no idea what he was talking about. When they get down, their egos get bruised by being unable to cure a boy who was possessed by a demon, and so they get all cranky. And then the disciples are arguing among each other about which of them was the greatest. To which Jesus responds by saying that whoever wants to be first must be last and servant of all. And he puts the little child on his knees and says, like this. And in today's reading, the disciples are all jealous and angry that someone who is not in their little group was successfully driving out demons in Jesus' name. You know, when the disciples a few verses ago could not do it. We tried to stop him because he was not following us. He's not on our team, Jesus. Jesus gently lets them know that the problem is not this anonymous healer, not some outsider. He says, whoever is not against us is for us. He explains that the problem is in themselves. Their small-mindedness, their parochialism, their possessive tribalism is going to keep others from following his way. If any of you put a stumbling block before one of these little ones who believe in me, it would be better for you if a great millstone were hung around your neck and you were thrown into the sea. My own humble paraphrase goes like this. Stop being jerks! If you guys who claim to follow me act like jerks, you will cause others to fall away. Cut it out. You've got a big Jesus sign on your t-shirt. People see you being horrible. They see the t-shirt. Like the person with the Jesus fish bumper sticker who flips you off in traffic. Yeah, that one. Or the televangelist who gets on national TV to say something so unchristian, so horrible, whether it's about women or people of color or gay and lesbian folk, and three-quarters of the country goes, ooh, that's what church is about? If any of you put a stumbling block before one of these little ones, it would be better for you if a great millstone were hung around your neck and you were thrown into the sea. Cut it out, Jesus is saying. Cut it out. Literally, well, no, figuratively, but seriously. It's interesting that Jesus figuratively or hyperbolically or symbolically uses amputation as the method of cutting away or moving away from these stumbling blocks. Now, I don't know too much about amputation as a medical procedure in the early first century, but in the early 19th century, it was ghastly. I've read some wonderful articles about amputation in the Civil War and earlier. It was a rough time before antibiotics. It's a rough time even with antibiotics. But back then, if you got, you know, a cut on your foot, it could be a death sentence. A broken bone or an infected cut could mean death by gangrene or sepsis. An amputation of a limb was the only way to save the whole body. But even that, in the 1830s in England, had a 40% fatality rate. If you went into the hospital to get something taken off, 40% chance of dying from it. It was not something to be taken lightly. The best surgeon of the day, back then in the 1830s in England, was Dr. Robert Liston. He was called the fastest knife in the West End. According to Matt Soniak, in a grimly wonderful article in The Atlantic magazine, said, his style may have seemed careless, but in the age before anesthesia, speed was essential to minimizing the patient's pain and improving their odds of surviving surgery. Slower surgeons sometimes had pain-racked and panicked patients wrestle free from their assistants and flee from the operating room. Only about 1 out of every 10 of Liston's patients died on the operating table at London's University College Hospital. His most famous and fastest amputation of a leg took 2.5 minutes. He was moving so fast that, according to the story, he took off a surgical assistant's fingers as he cut through a leg, and while switching instruments, he slashed a spectator's coat. The patient and the assistant both died from infections of their wounds, and the spectator was so scared that he'd been stabbed that he died of a heart attack on the spot. This fiasco is said to be the only known surgery in London Hospital with a 300% mortality rate. Amputation, literal or figurative, is not to be taken lightly. So after we read this shocking, gruesome, and confusing text from Mark, what are we supposed to do with it? Well, first of all, we stop and breathe and take a look at our lives. And we ask the tough question. What things are making me stumble in my life of faith? And just as crucial, what things do I do that might be making someone else stumble in their life of faith? Back when we lived in the Northeast Kingdom, Barb had a very wise friend in Plainfield who said, sin is anything that makes you less than fully who you are before God. Sin is anything that makes you less than fully who you are before God. Now, she was speaking for herself about addiction. In her case, an addiction to alcohol that controlled her life and put up a barrier between herself and God and everyone else around her for many years. She says that during that time she thought she was in control of her drinking and she never thought too much about God because she assumed that was for weak people. Until the day she realized she needed help. And she found her way to an AA meeting. And we've done sermons about this before. The first step she learned was about admitting she was powerless over her addiction. and that her life had become unmanageable. The second step spoke to her about a power greater than herself, which could restore her to sanity. The third step talked about turning her life over to God. The remaining nine steps went on from there, but those first three, she said, were plenty for her to chew on for a long time. She said that taking those first three steps was the hardest thing she'd ever done in her life. She said, I knew I had to do it. I knew I would die if I didn't do it. But it was like cutting part of me off. She quickly added that cutting off her addiction was the best thing she had ever done for herself and the people around her. But she said the hard part was that it was giving up the illusion that she was in control. That she didn't need God, that she was just fine, thank you very much. It hurt to give up that illusion. But because of that hurt, she is a much healthier and, I hate the word, but a much godlier person today. That is the power and the miracle of AA, that it is able to help people overcome their addictions by admitting their problems and relying on a power greater than themselves, however they define that power, so that they can lead healthier, more whole lives. But it's not only alcoholics that have an addiction that keeps them from being fully themselves, that separates them from a full relationship with God and with other people. Addictions come in many shapes and sizes. Many, many of us are affected in some way by an addiction that gets in the way of our relationship with God and with other people. For some, it's the visible addictions, an addiction to alcohol or to drugs or to overeating. For others of us, it is an addiction to work that keeps us apart from God and from our family and from our friends, even from ourselves, or our addiction to family. We may be addicted to an unhealthy relationship that tears us down rather than builds us up, which we believe we can't live without, and yet we find we can't live with either. We may be addicted to our security, to our safety, to our financial status, to our healthy bodies. Or like the disciples, we might be addicted to status and a powerful position in our community. We may simply be addicted to pleasing others and earning their thanks and praise. How can we tell if we're in a state of addiction? If we find ourselves not served by our work or our money or our relationships, but ruled by them, there may be a problem. If we are miserable when we discover that we are not in absolute control of our lives or someone else's life, there may be a problem. If we look to something other than God for our day-to-day sustenance, we may have a problem. When we become hooked on something or someone that does not help us to grow or be whole, but instead causes us to stumble in our faith and our living, then we have a problem. And we have to make a difficult choice. Much like Joshua's challenge on the border of the Promised Land. Choose this day whom you will serve. The idols of self, tribe, nation, ego, status, comfort, distraction, or the God beyond our imagination who 1 John simply describes as love. Love. Choose this day whom you will serve and cut the rest out of your life. This is one of the hardest spiritual disciplines there are. Because it's hard to be honest with ourselves about these things in our lives that come between us and God, between us and the people we hold dear, between us and our truest selves. And it's especially hard when the things we are addicted to are socially acceptable or even praised. I mean, yeah, you will not hear a lot of praise for the alcoholic, the active alcoholic in our society. But the workaholic who gets promotion after promotion by working constantly and ignoring the rest of his life or his family's life is praised as industrious. It's really hard to break that addiction because everyone's shaking your hand for it. The mother who is addicted to her children's dependency and cannot let a child grow up or let them go is praised for her devotion to her family. Hard to let go of an addiction that everyone pats you on the head for. Someone addicted to power within the community is praised for his selfless service. A chronic pleaser is praised for being so thoughtful and kind to everyone around them. Now, it's not that any of these things are wrong in themselves. They are wrong when they become ends unto themselves. When we feel we have to work, or we have to parent, or we have to please others in order to earn acceptance and love, or to distract ourselves from something more unpleasant going on underneath. That's when we become separated from God. That's when we become separated from those who love us without our having to earn it. The problem comes that when we feel we have to have the drink or a certain income or a particular car or a particular partner or to be in a certain amount of control simply to survive, that is when we become separated from ourselves. We become separated from God, who is able to provide us. We are promised with what we need. So what happens when we recognize our addictions, our separation from God, and decide to do something about it? For some people, 12-step programs provide answers and support that people need in order to admit their addictions and turn their lives over to God again. Other people find the ways to end the cycle that is driving their lives to destruction, ways to reconnect to God's love and grace through the support and guidance of friends, of counselors, of prayer, of meditation, of their church community, their pastor, the people around them. Everyone's got a different way. But the crucial thing to remember is that we are all prone to these things that separate us from God. And to change them, according to Jesus, we have to do some cutting. We have to learn to live without these drugs, that person, that constant work, that approval. And doing that is brutally hard. And sometimes it feels like you're cutting off a hand or a foot or tearing out an eye. But I've been told by so many people in recovery that an amazing thing happens when we cut those addictions out of our lives, as painful as that is. Rather than finding themselves with only one hand or one foot or one eye, they found themselves more whole than they ever were before. When we cut out that which separates us, our lives are richer and fuller than we could have ever believed possible. We begin to understand ourselves in a new and loving light. We begin to relate to and understand and love the people around us more fully and more freely without demeaning ourselves in the process. and we become newly connected with God, turning our lives over to the one who gave us life in the first place. In doing that, we discover a new relationship with the Holy that can illumine all our days. Jesus used really strong language in this teaching. And not just because hyperbole is effective, but because these strong words are needed to cut through our own defenses. This is the power of the gospel. The good news of Jesus Christ, who tells us, if your foot or your hand or your eye causes you to stumble, cut them out. And in doing so, for the first time since we can remember, we may find ourselves whole and holy.